Mika Handler is an old friend of mine, whom I know over 15 years. I will try to introduce him during the interview, and my first question is, you made your doctor as a politologist, introducing a sociological research on Finnish identity. As far as I remember, later on, you were invited to teach in one of Scandinavian art academies that chose your experience instead of a classical philosopher. Is the field of traditional philosophy becoming too narrow for contemporary art?
Yeah, sure. It's been like that because it's a kind of like a philosophy that only deals with philosophy itself is not communicative enough, so it has to be kind of like opened up and kind of like dealing with issues of everyday life. And this kind of classical philosophy is too much of its own thing, kind of like too narrow and looking inside of itself. So quite a lot of these kind of issues of identity, sexuality, globalization cannot be answered that well. Of course, you can interpret all kinds of philosophers in different ways, but you have to have people who want to do something with it. So it's kind of like very easy to do the difference. It's like not what something is, but what you do with it.
You have almost 20 years of experience in journalism, art and culture criticism. You've created various exhibitions both in Finland, in Berlin, and abroad. And you are teaching since 1997. What is art and can one teach it?
I guess the main point of it is that you always kind of like ask the question in a productive and in a fruitful way, that what is in every situation meaningful way of communicating something visually. So of course it's possible and even preferable to create situations where you exchange ideas and you bring people together that think through what in their circumstances is interesting art. Again, I mean, it's not only art, but what's art that says something to people where they live, something that communicates feelings, passions, fear, interest, values, wants, and everything that is about the way we live, where we live, with whom we live, and how we live. So I think it's kind of like a I think it's really important, especially nowadays, that you have these situations where for 4 to 6 years you can focus and concentrate on something that in itself is not productive, that it doesn't produce something that you can sell on its own, but some kind of a situation where you can make experiments, take risks, and learn by doing things that are not in itself primarily a product but something else. They can then produce something that can be sell, but it's not something that in itself is a product. So it's kind of like it's not kind of like safe haven. It's an alternative for this kind of like situations where everything has to be from the starting point calculated, that has to produce a result. So one of the benefits of art academies is that the result is not that interesting. It's the process of doing it that makes it interesting.
But in one of your books, you speak about artists as highly trained experts participating in the production of meanings in art as a means of livelihood to pay the bills.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, you know, that's one point of it, but I mean, if you take part in the production of knowledge within this field only because you need to pay your bills, it's very unlikely that what you produce is that interesting. There has to be the passion for it. You have to, you know, burn for it. You have to feel for the need to communicate something that you want to communicate. And that in itself is this kind of like a wish, this burning desire take part in the production of knowledge in this field. And of course, I think it's really important that through that one should also earn enough that you can live. But then, of course, it's like different compromises, the way you have to deal with it. I think it's kind of like it's again these priorities. What comes first? If it's first a product, I don't think it's that interesting. If it's first only to make money, it's not that interesting either. Mm-hmm. There has to be this kind of like risk of kind of like trying to do something that is not yet there, and that doesn't happen. Because that's very, very much against the whole idea of a product. Product doesn't, you know, produce any surprises. It does exactly what it's supposed to do. Whereas art, as an experience, should, you know, open different ways of being together, different ways of seeing who you are and where you are, and so on. In the end, that painting can be then sold, but it can't first be produced as something that has to sell. It sells because of its inner value, and the inner value is not there without those risks, that passion and so on. Mm-hmm.
You spoke, you mentioned now the example of a painting, and you spoke a little bit before about visual art. And far as I know, you're a person that really interests in the painting and the visual culture nowadays made, but you also speak about communication. Art communicates for itself, or do artists have to learn theory and have to learn how to speak so they can communicate about the pieces of art? In Russia, by art professionals, there is a terminus, discursive working artist. Is this something you teach in the school for the theory?
Yeah, sure. And I don't think they close one other out. I mean, if you do, there has to be a balance. But I think the priority here is, of course, the work of art, and that, communicating not as in kind of like claiming something, but you kind of like try to push forward versions of reality, stories of who we are and how we are. And there's this, the reality of the work in a space and in a time, but quite often it's for that work of art to develop for the one who does it, in order that it goes somewhere. It's very important also to talk about it, but not talk about it in the words of somebody else, but the one who does it learns how to use language so that it's his or her way of talking about his or her work. So I'm very much against of this idea that that artists would just take words out of philosophy books and put them as stickers on works of art. It never works. It just sounds and looks stupid. What we try to teach is that people learn words are tools, like any tools. You have to learn how to use them. You have to bring them close to you and use the words that are meaningful for you. If they are like alien and foreign, they may sound very interesting, but there's no content, it's just silly. So it's very much about that, trusting that the way you want to speak about it is the most meaningful one also. But I think it's really important to speak about them, because otherwise there's something that is not translatable in the works of art, and that's fine, that has to be there also. But at the same time, it's really giving for anyone to share the views that you have, why you do what you do. Because if you don't share those views and the knowledge, it's not going to go anywhere. It's not developing anywhere.
Mm-hmm. But only producing pieces of art in the atelier, it's not showing it to public. And that's why the medias are there, the art magazines, and you have been working for a long period as a journalist in the professional art magazines, and for instance, you were a review editor on the new the Nordic Art Review, and as far as I know, you are still writing from time to time critics. Mm-hmm. Would you agree that those artists have more chances to be supported by the attention of mass media, like of journalism or of magazines, who create art pieces explicitly apt for this cooperation?
No, no. It's not true at all. I mean, there's... I mean, first of all, journalists are not stupid. If it's only made for them, it stinks, then it can work once. But if it's not interesting as an as an art experience, it doesn't make any sense. So these kind of gimmicks, they don't function that well. And this kind of, like, you know, idea of shocking or something like that, it's very dated, and it functions once, and then it can, like, then it's gone. But there's, like, there's another distinction there, that it's clear that magazines follow what's new and what's trendy, and that can be quite kind of like a challenging question of how, because just because something is new or fresh in itself doesn't make it good or interesting, of course. So quite often these magazines are a little bit running after it, their own chasing their own tail, mm-hmm. like a rat, because they create this hype, and that's of course rather sad. But I mean, quite often magazines try to create their own kind of like hype, because they want to sell or they want to be popular, and then you just have to know how to read them. And don't take them that seriously. But there's another kind of like funny options with the magazines, is that what it costs to produce them, and where do you get good picture material? So it's actually quite funny, actually a very structural question, that why so much video and photography gets more attention quite often, is that because the material is already there. But if you want to have really good photos of paintings or installations, so you have to have a big budget for that, and you normally don't really have it. So the quality, I mean, the quality question comes nowadays. Most people have the equipment, but the equipment in itself is not enough. You have to have somebody, a really good photographer, to make a good photography or a very complex installation. And whereas, you know, one photograph of a photograph is enough, but to make the sense of an installation, you need five photographs. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you know, very simple reasons why something gets more attention and why something doesn't. But that in itself, I mean, the one, you know, if you take it seriously, what's it really? I mean, that's your own problem.
And a young artist should not try to manipulate this field.
Not really, no.
This is not something to develop the strategy to work with.
No, because it's like then you're playing in the then you kind of like it's an illusion that you would make the rules. You still kind of like, you know, play along the rules made by somebody else. I mean, it depends, of course, what one wants. If you want fast fame and big money, go to business. Or, you know, become whatever, porno star, I don't care. But I mean, learn how to run very fast. But it's like, you know, if you're looking for something else, that's, it's not very useful.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about trends and hypes. Now in Berlin, there's a Berlin Biennale, and entering the courtyard of this exhibition space called Kunstwerke, that organized first and holds every 2 years this big exhibition and huge event, one can, as entering this courtyard, one can find an accurate writing on the wall, a quote by Walter Benjamin, a highly respected German philosopher. And this quote says, "A work that shows the correct political tendency need show no other quality." Is this slogan valid in general for becoming artists?
No. Absolutely not.
Very often, postmodernism is seen or described negatively as an anything goes game. Your book of 2000, Why Do I Like Rock Music, is underlined as a theoretical discourse on contemporary visual art and culture in the 1990s and also as a defense of postmodern plurality. What do you think are the mechanisms assessing this diversity? What in the end, the judging principle, the history, the market, or some hypernatural moral instances?
Or the God. I don't know. I mean, that's part of the whole question of plurality, that there's no one instant that comes afterwards and says yes or no. But the whole thing is that this anything goes, it's just a pseudo-problem. Anything goes is only possible if people are lazy and if they don't care about what they do, and if it's only for one-time thing. But any activity that is based on long-term, serious, coherent effort in taking part in the production of knowledge knows that it doesn't exist on its own. It always comes from somewhere. It exists in relation to the past, to the present time, and to the future. It comes from somewhere. It exists somewhere right now, and it continues somewhere else. So it comes from a context, and it stays in a context, and it's going to shape a context. And it's based on the kind of like the past of that context and the present sense of the context. What makes sense and what's interesting. And there are just really many different contexts. There are very many different discourses based on kind of historical, political reasons. It's not the same discourse in Helsinki as it is in Stockholm. It's not the same discourse in Paris that it is in Berlin. There are overlapping issues, but there are still kind of like a very, very much local colored questions. And then, more importantly than that, there are always overlapping fields or levels. So you got the level of the market, but then you got the level of professional audiences, professional, like your other artists talking to other artists. Then you got the level of research. At the level of teaching and so on, and I mean these don't close one another out, but it would be just extremely silly to say that everything that sells is good. Of course it's not, but it doesn't mean otherwise that the art that doesn't sell is good in itself. It's just different kinds of formalism, it's just simply stupid. So postmodernity is actually the demand to every time to define why something is interesting and something is good. So it's kind of like a way to escape this beforehand claims of formalistic stupidity.
Mm-hmm. In one of your works, you criticize the principle of avant-garde as the highest pinnacle of modernism and suggest the idea of moments of resistance. So this fight, does it happen today?
I don't understand that.
If you're speaking about moments of resistance, yeah. Is it a battlefield that taking part in our everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, this can be actually kind of like explained. I mean, it's in the latest book, Artistic Research, there's a longer interview with Olafur Eliasson. It can actually be explained quite well with his example. Because if you think that avant-garde was just about that, you know, somewhere in the kind of near or further future, there lies that kind of like aim that, and if we strive just good and successfully towards it, we might achieve it. So it's like question, where is that moment? Where do you have to be kind of like active and participating and kind of like reflective and critical? It's like in Olafur's version, the question is, where is the utopia? So in this kind of classical modernistic sense, utopia is, and the answer is somewhere there in the horizon, where his idea is the utopia is every day here and right now, in our ability to see differently, to tell different stories, to be aware in a different way, to shape the everyday life that you live. So that's the moments of resistance. Mm-hmm. So it's not somewhere out there, it's exactly here.
You spoke about your latest book, and one before this was, as far as I know, was calling Everything or Nothing, and it was published first in Finnish for academy students to introduce them into the field of the art theory.
Yeah.
In this book, you start with critique of Enlightenment. Then you introduce the post-structuralism with examples of Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. Then you speak about hermeneutics, feminism, and post-colonialism. Could one add to this list also, let's say, psychoanalysis or leftist theories?
Yeah, of course. It was just like that book in itself, in its introduction to critical theory. So it didn't even try to cover everything. It just took a couple of central positions that I just happened to find most interesting and valuable for me. But obviously there are different people that one could have chosen, but that's for somebody else to write. And it's also like. It's only an introduction to any of this, because it's like in 15 pages you try to introduce what's feminism. Good luck with that. So of course, it's kind of like, you know, it's an impossible, but you have to start with somewhere. And it's kind of like, because it's just a fact that you can't teach to art students Derrida without situating and contextualizing him. So unless you know from what position Derrida speaks from, against whom does he argue with, why does he say what does he say, it doesn't make any sense what he says. It's absolutely irrelevant unless you know the context where Derrida speaks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a universal theory he does. He's very, very much against of it all the time. So like reading Derrida, it's a very long process. It's a very giving process also, but it takes a long time, and you know, have to know why did he write what he wrote in different times. And then you have to know the context, then you have to know the situation in France in the 50s and the 60s and the other ones he was arguing with. You have to know Derrida's enemy before you can make any sense why he says what he says.
In this book, Everything or Nothing, you describe philosophy or art theory as a huge house, strange house, with lots of entrances that are free to choose.
Yeah.
But let us continue this metaphor. What kind of house is it? Is it a supermarket where you enter to purchase? Or is it a council office where you could be tortured by moving from one cell to another? Or is it a brothel where you are welcomed only if you have enough funds? In the case of philosophy, let's say plenty of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's you forgot one kind of like open source institution in most of cities in the world. It's called library.
Yeah. And if you're speaking about the libraries, let me ask you the last question. Your articles and books have impressive titles. A review on Finnish deputies gathered in a group of nature photography lovers was called by you Natural Born Killer. The book about localized ethics, the situated self and particularism in contemporary art was called by you Rock the Boat. You also edited an anthology on contemporary views on art and exhibitions under the unexpected title Stopping the Process. Isn't art theory something serious?
Well, I mean, you think that the titles are good. I mean, my wife thinks they are very, very bad, I think. But it's again like, of course it's serious, but I mean the question is not about serious or unserious, it's a question of how do you awake interest in something and giving it a title that it's about some kind of like a psychoanalytic perception on counteractive terroristic views is one way. I mean, that's not an example, but I mean, it's just about catchy titles are good titles. I mean, you have to understand it has to provoke you. It has to kind of like, it doesn't make them good. I mean, they often just, you know, remakes of popular movies or pop songs or whatever. Rock the Boat, it's a very, very old 70s disco song. So it's like there's nothing kind of like original in it. It's just kind of like playing with words.
You have a huge experience in working in different places. You are situated both in Helsinki and in Berlin, and you've done exhibitions in different countries. Would you like to say something explicitly for the Russian art public, or like young artists that are in education? Where should they start if they are interested in contemporary art as a universal language?
They should start at home. They should keep up the hope and remember that there are always places where you can, you know, make it. That if you don't like it in Moscow, go somewhere else. And if you don't like there somewhere else, go back to Moscow. Just like, again, this there's different opportunities all around, and it's no longer one place that where you can, you know, make it. And it's like, unless, and I think the most important is just the old punk slogan, do it yourself. Don't wait for somebody else, do it yourself.
Okay, but if people have to move, then the biggest problem is to start to know the language, like the English language. But in the same case, if they're starting with the arts, they have to know the theoretical discourse to come to discussion when they are moving. In your book, you mentioned three earthquakes in the minds. This is Marx, Freud, and Saussure. Mm-hmm. So, where should they start? By learning the language or by learning the theory?
No, they should learn all of them side by side. But, you know, I think it's again like confusion that there's a... I mean, he has to start with the wish to do something visually, and then to locate that wish with people who are working in the same or similar fields. That you start to learn by people who take similar kind of photographers, photographies, and ask why. Why did they take these photographies? And so if you do kind of like, you know, big installations, then you study people who did those installations, and you ask them why did they do it? Why did Smithson did what he did in the 60s? And then instead of just repeating what he did in the 60s, you would do a, you know, contemporary version of it, but thinking it through. And then at the same time, you read yourself into it. Of course, it takes time, but I mean, learning a language, that's just part of any proper education. People should learn 3-4 languages. Everybody can do it. You don't do it when you are 25. You just learn along. So I mean, again, like it's just kind of like. I mean, just like I'm actually saying quite a lot of things, but I mean, one thing is very simple. I mean, unless whatever it is that you do, unless it's something you can enjoy, you're doing something wrong.
Thank you very much for this interview. I think with these nice words, we will finish.
Schön. Das lustig mit dir.